Hello, welcome to Future Tense. Anthony Fennell here, with some interesting facts. I got these facts online. Here we go. 24 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube each minute. The brain uses 17% of the body's energy. Yawning actually wakes you up. And 1 out of 8 couples married in the United States in 2008 met via social media. As I say, I got all those facts simply by trawling online. And here's a final fact for you. I have absolutely no idea whether they're true or not. But isn't that always the case with facts? Today on Future Tense, fact and fiction, and how do we tell the difference in the modern world?
I think that when expertise is having to do battle with opinion, in a world in which everyone gets to have an opinion and everyone gets to express their opinion and other people can read all of those opinions, it's very difficult for people to agree or come to a consensus about what expert knowledge is or whether indeed there should be expert knowledge.
Now, as we often like to do on this program, we're going to begin our look at the current and the future with a reminder about the past. And to help us, here's Dr. Mary Poovey, a professor of English at New York University and author of the book, A History of the Modern Fact.
Facts is a very, very old concept. It really goes back to Aristotle, who had in mind a different notion of facts, because he thought that facts were what most people believed, or commonplaces, or whatever usually is, or what is. And then the modern sense of the fact really belongs to the 17th century and Francis Bacon, who began to argue that metaphysical truths were less important than the truths that you could infer from objects that you observe in the physical world, in the natural world, especially if you could count them. So that's when we began to think of facts as having to do with observations and objective observations of things that everybody could see and count in front of them.
And observations, objective observations, as you say, many people, though, believe, don't they, now that facts are immovable, that once something is defined as a fact, it won't change or it shouldn't change. How modern is that understanding of the fact?
Well, I think that from Bacon's time, facts were always perceived as belonging to theories. And so I don't think that Bacon would have said that facts couldn't change. But I do think that people have a kind of longing for a world of facticity that doesn't have any historical dimension whatsoever. But I would say that outside of the realm of natural science, that kind of fact that never changes is more a dream than it is something that people have concurred about or believed in with a kind of consensus. I think the heyday of facts in the simple sense of unchanging objective truth might well have been the late 1940s and 1950s, when at least the Western powers could declare that in the name of truth and science, they had liberated the world from the lies of the Nazis. And so this notion of the objective fact, I think, came to be set in political opposition to what was seen as a very explicit form of lying, of just not telling the truth. But I think that the notion that facts are simply unchanging objective statements about a real world, as I said before, I think that's always been an ideal, except in those moments at which there's been the kind of political will to back up that ideal with claims that it really exists in the world.
And yet so many of us, when it suits us, still cling to that notion of the objective fact. Is that one of the reasons why we have so much polarization in our political discourse these days, or so much discord over say, climate change and the issues around climate change?
Right. Well, I might turn that around and say that the reason so many people cling to the idea that there is such a thing as a fact that is completely objective is because the media world now is so completely saturated with beliefs that people hope and wish for sort of a realm outside of opinion where everybody would just agree. But of course, now we live in a world in which opinion saturates everything, and people tend to seek out on the internet or on the television set confirmation of their own opinions and own beliefs. So at the same time, people pay lip service to the notion that there is such a thing as an objective fact, and they want those facts to ratify what they already believe.
So opinion, then, is our search for truth. It's become the new truth. It used to be facts, now it's opinion.
I think it's become, I think opinion is confirmation, and that we may say we're looking for truth, but I think that what most people are looking for is a confirmation that what they believe is right.
What role, I mean, just going back to the history of facts, what role does the whole notion of the fact play for us? What does it give us?
Well, I think in the 19th century, for example, it gave people, particularly in the natural sciences, a way to adjudicate between truth claims. So if one scientist could collect data that was really indisputable, then his truth claims could be seen to be more effective, and they had more social authority because they were based on more data than another scientist's truth claims. So I think in the 19th century, facts really was a way of settling disputes about beliefs, and a way, particularly of scientific communities reaching consensus on what they agreed to believe was true. And then the whole practice of natural science has developed upon the basis that scientific communities can observe the world without bias and can reach consensus about that. So I think that there has been historically an extremely important role for this idea of the fact. The problem is that as media forms have proliferated in the 20th century and 21st century, and as political opinions have become more diverse, facts are no longer able to outweigh other kinds of motives, and so they're no longer able, appeals to facts are no longer able to play the kind of adjudicating social authority role that they used to be able to play.
And that's given over to opinion, as you say. Do you see a future, though, for the fact? Do you see a time where we may go back to the fact?
Boy, I hope so. It's hard to know, because I think that from the political left, as it were, facts have been attacked on the basis that there's always a certain amount of self-interest in any claim to be a fact, even on the part of natural scientists. And on the right, of course, facts are accused of being ideologically charged as well. So I think that in some ways, the whole post-structuralist movement, postmodernist movement in the 70s and 80s and 90s has helped undermine the credibility of the fact. But I think without social consensus, whether you call it fact or whether you call it simply for the welfare of the nation or the welfare of the globe, without social consensus, it's very hard to see how the world is going to get beyond the kind of sectarian divisions that we're now living with.
Hi, my name is Dr. Ulrich Ecker. I'm a cognitive scientist from the University of Western Australia School of Psychology. My research looks at the effects of misinformation, and I try to understand how people process misinformation and how it affects their cognition. Now, misinformation is everywhere. Obama is a Muslim, vaccinations cause autism, asylum seekers are breaking the law, and GM foods cause cancer. Unfortunately, retracting misinformation, you know, just saying that's actually not true, does very little to alleviate the effects of misinformation. Once it's out there, misinformation will affect people's memory, their reasoning, their decision-making. Constantly updating and correcting our understanding of the world is a big task. We don't have the time, the resources, or the motivation to assess the evidence for each and every claim we encounter. So sometimes we just have to go with the heuristics. How does this fit in with what I already know? How does it fit with what I believe? What do other people think about this? And so on. Now, usually these heuristics are benign. However, when people's beliefs are very strong, those beliefs will bias information processing and will lead to what we know as motivated reasoning. So that's when people with strong beliefs and motivations attend to and interpret information in a way that supports their beliefs. Motivated reasoning is a major obstacle for rational argument, obviously. So if someone wants to believe that Obama is a Muslim, or if someone wants to believe that virtually all of the world's climate scientists have conspired to make up a huge global climate change hoax, it's very difficult to change their minds, even when the actual evidence is very, very clear. Motivated reasoning is facilitated by the contemporary media landscape. There's a lack of fact-checking in much of the new media, where the main focus is on getting information out quickly, and where information is spread not based on veracity, but you know, based mainly on its likelihood of evoking an emotional response in the recipient. So misinformation is an issue for any political citizen who wants to form opinions and make decisions based on facts, and if we want evidence-based practice and policy in a democratic society, then it's a huge challenge for science communication, journalism and education, and they will have to take on the challenges that are associated with misinformation.
Dr. Ulrich Ecker in Western Australia, and before him, Professor Mary Poovey from New York University.
President Obama's backing of the mosque appears to have skewed the perception many Americans have of the religion he practices. Now, the Time poll found that nearly one in four identified him as a Muslim.
First, there has been a bit of climate change. I think there has
it's
been
the hottest decade in history, Pat.
Would you hold up a minute?
But it's
here?
The hottest decade. You keep citing facts that aren't facts. It's the hottest, warmest decade in history.
So, Lord Monckton, what do you hope to add to the climate debate by coming to New Zealand?
Why do you think one in four think that he is a Muslim?
We're not going to expect very much global warming over the next century, possibly as little as one Celsius, not much more than that.
Vice President Gore made some startling and in some cases I think deeply misleading assertions. For example, the rate of new discoveries is falling for energy. That's factually not true.
People living next to wind farms could be the unintended victims of good intentions. It's called wind turbine syndrome.
Barack Obama, raised as a Muslim, this is huge.
It's all out there, the good and the bad. When people were being idealistic about how the internet was going to revolutionize democracy, I don't think they took seriously enough people's desire to be proven right and to find information that's consistent with their point of view. And here in the United States, there's all sorts of information for a voter who really does want to be better informed. But it's also very easy to wrap yourself in a cocoon of information that supports your point of view and to avoid information that might contradict what you already believe. And important to be clear that that's not true of everybody. Lots of people do have relatively balanced information diets. But for those people who care the most about politics, many of us are especially concerned that those folks may be the ones who are wrapping themselves in those protective cocoons.
Dr. Brendan Nyhan is our next guest, and in keeping with the theme of this program, here's an important biographical fact. Dr. Nyhan is an assistant professor in government at Dartmouth College in the United States. Brendan Nyhan.
I think it's important for your audience to remember that we all do this. This is very much a human problem. We rely on our predispositions to filter the information that's out there, to make judgments about what is or is not likely to be true. And if any of us look at the information we choose to consume, I think we'll frequently find that it is slanted towards our point of view. This really is a fundamental problem of human psychology or limitation. It has lots of virtues. I think we would drive ourselves crazy if we tried to objectively weigh the evidence for every single thing we did as human beings. We would go crazy. But as voters and as citizens, we do have this problem of maintaining a balanced point of view, and especially maintaining a point of view that's consistent with the facts. That's really been one of my biggest concerns in my research.
Now tell us about the experiment that you did where you asked people to read a mock news article about George W. Bush, the former president, and then you followed it with another article which contained a correction. Explain what happened there, what the result was.
What we did was we showed people different versions of this article. Now, they only saw one version, so we compared the people who saw a version that included corrective information that was disproving the statement made by President Bush, in this case about his tax cut increasing government revenue. Those readers who saw the correction, how they responded to it varied depending on their point of view. And so the people we're particularly concerned with here are the ones who are most likely to reject the correction, which in this case are conservatives, the ones who are likely to view Bush favorably. So when they get the corrective information saying that tax cuts actually decrease government revenue, my co-author Jason Reifler and I found that they actually became more likely to believe in the misperception that tax cuts would increase government revenue. So in other words, the correction made the misperception worse rather than better among this group. This is a result we found in another study. It's something we call the backfire effect, and we think it has very troubling implications for how we try to correct misperceptions in education and the media.
And that's because we come to facts with these predispositions, as you said earlier.
That's right. We come in with some point of view, and we're challenged in that point of view. And sometimes we'll go along with that correction, but if we object to it strongly enough or we're threatened enough by the information it contains, we argue back in our own minds. And in the process of doing that, sometimes we end up convincing ourselves more strongly in the idea that's being challenged than we would have otherwise.
Now, your experiment has implications, doesn't it, for how the whole climate change debate has played out in countries like Australia and the United States. A lot of people are mystified, particularly scientists, that they give over more and more information to correct misperceptions, but they complain it doesn't seem to do any good. Well, your experiment seems to explain why, doesn't it?
It does. It's very hard to change people's minds. And climate change is a great example of an issue where, as the issue has become more politicized, people have divided more sharply along political lines, at least in the United States, and I imagine in Australia as well. our theory of what's going on when people receive corrective information they don't like is that it's threatening to them. It's threatening to their worldview or their sense of themselves. And so in one experiment, we had people write an essay about a time when they upheld a value that was important to them, something that has nothing to do with politics, but might buttress people's self-concept or self-worth and thereby make them better able to handle the threat posed by unwelcome information. And we found in a series of experiments, including one about climate change, that this made people more open-minded. So it does suggest that it is this threatening nature of corrective information that makes some of these issues so difficult.
Is there also an issue here about reputational damage, that we've become so used to the idea that, say, politicians will exaggerate facts that, you know, not necessarily even tell us incorrect facts, but certainly exaggerate facts, that there's very little damage to them when they do that, when they're caught out? Is that a problem?
I think we don't take seriously enough the supply of misleading information. It's easy to bemoan the limitations of human psychology, but in most cases, people are responding to the information that's being fed to them by elites. And I do think we need stronger reputational sanctions against politicians and commentators who mislead people. If the incentives are wrong, if it's too lucrative or politically advantageous to mislead people, then we shouldn't be surprised when elites do it. You know, here in the United States, the fact-checking movement has tried to change the culture of journalism in a way that would hold politicians accountable and thereby raise the reputational costs of misleading people, but that's very much a work in progress. It's a difficult challenge to overcome.
You're on RN, and this is Future Tense with Anthony Fennell. Also available online and via iTunes. Our Twitter name is RN Future Tense, all one word. And we broadcast across the Asia-Pacific region via Radio Australia.
Now, as Dr. Nyhan mentioned, there is quite a healthy movement in the United States directed at what he called fact-checking. Organisations and individuals working to try and develop systems and services to help ordinary folk like us better determine fact from fiction. So in the time we've got left today, I want to introduce you to two of them. The first is a well-established news service called PolitiFact, which has actually won a Pulitzer Prize for its work. And the second is still really more of a concept in development, a work in progress. It's called Hypothesis. Let's go with PolitiFact first, and its editor, Bill Adair, who you'll remember from our recent program on digital politics and the US election.
What PolitiFact is old-style accountability journalism done for the web. So we research a factual claim that a politician makes, and we determine whether we think it's true, half-true, false, or our lowest rating, pants on fire. And what distinguishes us from some previous fact-checking in American journalism is that we make that conclusion. Much of journalism has been about laying out both sides in an argument and leaving it to the reader to conclude whether something is true or false. We feel that journalists have an obligation to go that one step further and say that statement is false. And so that's what we do. We've been around now for 5 years. We've done more than 6,000 fact checks on everyone from the mayor of Portland, Oregon, to the president of the United States, who we've rated well over 300 times.
Now, 6,000 fact checks, that's an awful lot of statements to actually investigate and then verify. But in the grand scheme of things, it's really a drop in the bucket, isn't it? How do you decide which statements you're going to take on? Which ones are the important ones to try and verify?
What we do every day is we look at the claims that are being made and we say, what are the things that voters are hearing that they are wondering about? So what we want to do is satisfy people's curiosity. If they hear a campaign advertisement and they hear an attack in that ad and they wonder, is that true? Then that's something that we want to fact check. So every day we try to pick the most interesting, provocative, and newsworthy claims, and those are the ones that we fact check. We approach our ratings with an important principle that says a politician must be able to back up what they say. And if they cannot, we will do our best to check it out and to try to find the evidence that they're relying on. But ultimately, a United States senator or the president of the United States or a candidate for president should be able to back up what they say. And if they can't, then we rate it false.
Now, you have a website where you hold the various statements that you fact-checked. What are you trying to do to get that information out to a broader public?
The website actually gets an awful lot of traffic. During some of the bigger events during our presidential campaign, we had hundreds of thousands of page views. One day we had nearly 1 million page views. So we're getting a lot of traffic on the website. But in addition to that, we're broadcasting our conclusions through partnerships with NPR, our public radio network, through television segments that we do on CNN and CNN International, through appearances on other cable news channels. We also sell our content to American newspapers. So between all of those things, we're reaching a very large audience, and I think it has also inspired lots of other fact-checking by news organizations. So I think the word is beginning to get out.
Is it any coincidence that the rise of groups like yours comes at a period when there's a sense of increased polarization in many parts of American society?
I think it's definitely not a coincidence. What has caused the polarization? Well, I think one of the big factors in the polarization in American politics is the rise of very partisan media, both on cable television, on radio, and on the web, where people who are either conservative or liberal go to conservative or liberal sources for their news. And those sources tend to be factories for talking points, where the candidates and the spokesmen for the elected officials spew partisan talking points that fire up the partisan crowd. So if you're conservative and you go to a conservative television network like Fox, you're going to hear from conservative politicians who are using their own talking points. Those talking points are often filled with factual claims, and those are the very things that we are fact-checking, and that's occurring on both sides in our discourse. And I often think that American politics has become the battle of the talking point, where both sides hurl their talking points at each other, but rarely do they actually talk. And that's maybe not good for democracy, but it's great for fact-checkers.
Bill Adair, editor of PolitiFact, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Need I say it? There's a link on our website. Just search Future Tense and RN. And while you're there, you'll also find details about the book of the series. It's called The Future and Related Nonsense, and it's available online and in Australia through ABC Books and other retailers. Okay, gratuitous book and website plug out of the way, let's go to our final guest, Dan Whaley, another North American. His project, as I mentioned earlier, is called Hypothesis, and it's a bit of a difficult one to grasp. It's about crowdsourcing the process of fact-checking, but also developing technology that you'll one day be able to load onto your computer or digital device, which will then help you to check the veracity of facts while you're reading articles or blog posts. That's the plan anyway. Once again, it's called Hypothesis, and its developer is Dan Whaley.
The way it'll work is that in whatever it is that you're using to get at information, usually a browser if you're online, or maybe if you're at a website that would have this embedded in it, you could kind of call out to this resource and overlay it on top of, say, the website that you're at, almost like a heads-up display for information.
So it's almost like an annotation layer, isn't it, over an existing website. So you'll visit a website, you'll look at a story, say, and this other layer of annotation might come over the top that might alert you to a problem with a perceived problem with a fact or to some other comment that's relevant to that particular story. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. In fact, the new standard that's been proposed for how to point into information and contribute to it is actually called annotation. You know, our teachers used to annotate the side of our papers when we turned them in. Annotation has been going on for as long as people have been writing and particularly creating printed material. But there is a new standard for data structures and kind of interoperable standards for how to do this and how to share those. And we think that's one of the most promising developments that we're leveraging and we're benefiting from in trying to bring this forward.
So in one sense, it won't be that different from Wikipedia in one way, will it? In the sense that you can look at a story and you'll be able to then see where other people have thought a section of that story is incorrect or have asked for sources, you know, the sources behind that particular fact. It'll be similar to that in a way, won't it?
In fact, we actually sometimes refer to this as inverting Wikipedia and taking it out to the edge of the internet, the event horizon where information first develops. The big difference is that Wikipedia is a destination. You go there, it's an encyclopedia, which means it's a consolidation of knowledge into topics. But the kind of battleground of where opinion forms and where information happens that affects us on a daily basis really happens in a much bigger sphere. And so the challenge is to take that kind of crowdsourced intelligence of Wikipedia and bring it to the rest of the internet. And that's exactly what we're trying to do.
And just like Wikipedia, then, for this to work effectively and comprehensively, you're going to need a very large number of volunteers, aren't you, to help do the annotation, to help do the fact-checking?
Absolutely. Eventually, we do hope to have large numbers of contributors. The question is, how do you get there when you're starting from zero? And this is a classic, what's called cold start problem. We've spent a lot of time, it's probably, other than creating a product that actually works and does this, it's probably the next biggest challenge that we're focused on right now.
And just like Wikipedia, there needs to be a checking of the fact checkers, doesn't there? How do you maintain, or how do you imagine you'll be able to maintain the integrity of the system when so many people are going to be involved?
Well, you've really hit on perhaps one of the most important parts of the project, which is how, when, you know, we call this the internet peer-reviewed. So the second part is key there. What is the peer review function and how do you do that? Because if you don't, what you'll get is noise. You'll get graffiti. You know, people, you give them the ability to annotate the web and they'll go scribble. And you, the community that you'll get will ultimately end up being the lowest common denominator. So this domain is, in computer theory, is called reputation modeling or distributed moderation. And there's been a lot of research and successful projects that capitalize on that. You know, we see smaller examples of this every day. So if we use eBay or we use Amazon, we can see that some reviews or some people bubble to the top because they're consistently ranked highly by their peers in the transactions that they engage in. And in eBay, those are financial transactions. And Amazon, it's maybe that they bought a book and they reviewed it and what we resonated with what they have to say. So we're using similar human behavior, but we're using different algorithms that help us check the checkers in a way that's blind and randomized so that we try to remove the inherent bias that all people have.
Hypothesis, it's called, a work in progress. And that was businessman and entrepreneur Dan Whaley. And they have around $250,000 in initial funding, I understand, in order to build their prototype. And we'll add them to our list of projects to keep watch on.